Let's turn back to the book of Exodus. Exodus chapter 10. We'll be looking at the last two plagues on Egypt this hour. And those last three plagues we entitled the death plagues or the dread plagues because they are the most severe of all the plagues. As you recall, by way of introduction, the plagues have a very distinct pattern in Egypt, and they are in sets of three, and each set is worse than the last one. The first three were just discomfort plagues. They merely produced discomfort, not any real damage. The next three brought about real damage, destruction. There was personal property destroyed. Livestock was destroyed. The final three add the added dimension of death. Now, we looked in Psalms last hour, and we noted that the first two plagues did bring some death, but the last three plagues are notable as being the worst, the death plagues. And they start out with the locusts, and that's chapter 10, verses 1 through 20. Let's read those. Well, let's read first the warning, verse 1 through 11. 10:1 says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I may perform these signs of mine among them, and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson, how I made a mockery of the Egyptians and how I performed my signs among them, that you may know that I am the Lord.' Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said to him, 'Thus says the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go that they may serve me. For if you refuse to let my people go, behold, tomorrow I will bring locusts into your territory. They shall cover the surface of the land so that no one will be able to see the land. They will also eat the rest of what is escaped, that what is left to you from the hail. And they will eat every tree which sprouts for you out of the field. Then your houses shall be filled, and the houses of all your servants, and the houses of all the Egyptians. Something which neither your fathers nor your grandfathers have seen from the day that they came upon the earth until this day.' And he turned and went out from Pharaoh. Pharaoh's servants said to him, 'How long will this man be a snare to us? Let the men go that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not realize that Egypt is destroyed?' So Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh, and he said to them, 'Go, serve the Lord your God.' 'Who are the ones that are going?' Moses said, 'We shall go with our young and our old, with our sons and our daughters, with our flocks and our herds, we shall go, for we must hold a feast to the Lord.' Then he said to them, 'Thus may the Lord be with you if I ever let you go and your little ones go. Take heed, for evil is in your mind. Not so. Go now, the men among you, and serve the Lord, for that is what you desire.' So they were driven out from Pharaoh's presence." So again, they gave a warning. And the warning this time is the previous plague of the storm, the hail and the fire, had destroyed the flax and barley crops. And But the wheat and the spelt were not destroyed because they matured later. They weren't grown enough to be destroyed by a hailstorm yet. 9:31 says that, "Now the flax and barley were ruined, for the barley was in the ear and the flax was in the bud, but the wheat and the spelt were not ruined, for they ripen late." So the wheat and the spelt were not ruined. And that's what the locust would destroy. They were going to wipe out the wheat and the spelt. If you're wondering what spelt is, it's just a particular variety of wheat. It is a wheat, but it's a particular variety. So he says the wheat and the spelt. So now we see, for the first time here, we see that it's not only Pharaoh up against Moses. Pharaoh's gods, of course, but his advisors as well, his officials. And we see that, verse 7, Pharaoh's servant said to him, "How long will this man be a snare to us?" So even they are blaming Moses yet. And verse 4 through 6 give us the nature of the plague. And the nature of the plague, in verse 4, it says, "For if you refuse to let my people go, behold, tomorrow I will bring locusts into your territory. They shall cover the surface of the land so that no one will be able to see in the land. They will also eat the rest of the wheat that has escaped, what is left to you from the hail, and they will eat every tree which sprouts for you out of the field. Your houses will be filled, the homes are the houses of all your servants and the houses of all the Egyptians," and so on and so forth. So it's a very devastating plague again. In fact, the locust represents one of the most destructive examples of a collective power destroying things. Locusts were much feared in Egypt. The Egyptians prayed to their gods for protection from locusts. So again, we get back to the same old story. It's God versus the gods of Israel, or the God of Israel versus the gods of Egypt. And now he's going to attack more of their gods. This is Anubis, the jackal god. That's a model of the box they found in the treasury room of Tutankhamun's tomb, by the way. He had a box there with Anubis sitting on top, and inside were the canopic jars. You know what canopic jars are? When they mummified them, they took out their innards and put them in jars, put them in a box. Anyway, Anubis was the god of the fields. So he should have been able to protect them against locusts because he's the god of the fields. And then we have Isis. Isis was the protector against locusts. And Osiris was the god of the crops, fertility. This is them and their son, Horus. Horus was the son of Osiris and Isis. Remember, we told that story that this is Horus and that's Osiris and that's Isis. Remember, we told the story that Osiris supposedly died and then he was resurrected long enough to impregnate Isis, and she bore the son Horus, who was the falcon god. You really need a program to keep all the Egyptian gods straight. There's tons of them. But those are the ones that this plague is attacking. And there's old Nut again. Remember, we looked at her last hour. She was the sky goddess. Should have been able to protect them from the locusts from the sky. That's Nut. If you weren't here last hour, she has an elongated body, and she those are her feet back here and her hands up here. And every day the sun would go through the sky, and when it got over here, she would eat the sun, and it would go through her digestive system. You can see it represented there going through her, and it would come out of her unmentionable parts, and the whole thing would start again. That's what they believed anyway. But she was supposed to be able to protect them from things that came from the sky, like locusts. And Osiris and Isis were supposed to be able to protect them from things that came out of the sky, and Anubis was supposed to protect them. So all these three Egyptian gods were totally useless against the plague of locusts. And that was God's point. He's showing the Egyptians and the Israelites that these are false gods, because we'll see later the Israelites were worshiping the Egyptian gods. Going back to the nature of the plague, I want to read a comment here from a guy named Pierre, and I don't know how to pronounce his last name. It's M-O-N-T-E-T. It's probably French. Would that be Montet? Anybody know? Oh, well. That was his name anyway. He said this in his book, Eternal Egypt, on page 39. No one who has ever seen the locust at work accuses the Bible account of hyperbole. You know what hyperbole is? That means overstating something. Like, I'm so hungry I could eat a horse. That's hyperbole. You're overstating. And he says anybody that knows about locusts would not accuse the Bible of hyperbole, overstating their destructive power. In 1926 and 1927, a small swarms of the African migratory locusts were spotted in an area 50 by 120 miles on the plains of the River Niger near Timbuktu. The next year, swarms invaded Senegal and Sierra Leone. By 1930, the whole of the West Africa was falling away at the pests, flailing away. Everybody in Western Africa was flailing away at the pests with everything that moved. I mean, they were swinging at them with everything they had, but the locusts didn't seem to notice. Swarms reached Khartoum, more than 2,000 miles to the east of Timbuktu, then turned south, spreading across Ethiopia, Kenya, and the Belgian Congo, and in 1932, striking into the lush farmland of Angola and Rhodesia. Before the plague finally sputtered out 14 years after it began, it affected 5 million square miles of Africa. Now, that's an area that's about double the size of the United States. So these guys are destructive. In fact, a locust is capable of eating its own weight daily. Now, that's almost as much as I can eat. These guys can put it away. And a typical swarm, 1 mile square, normally contains between 1 and 200 million locusts. So 1 square mile, 200 million locusts. How much does a locust weigh? An ounce? I used an ounce just for, I don't know how much a locust weighs. Locusts are the swarming phase of shorthorn grasshoppers, if you ever wondered what a locust was. It's a grasshopper in its swarming phase. So if they had 200 million locusts on a square mile of land that were eating their weight daily, they would lose 6,250 tons per square mile per day. That's pretty destructive. And swarms covering 400 square miles have been recorded. So we're talking serious damage here. They can flap their wings nonstop for 17 hours. They can cruise at 10 to 12 miles an hour and for 20 hours. Depending on the wind conditions, they can move collectively. The swarm can move up to 60 miles a day. That's why they got 2,000 miles in Africa. So we're talking about severe destruction here. I mean, they killed everything that the hail left. They ate it. And in verse 2, we have something interesting. A new purpose, or a new aspect of the purpose of the plagues, is given in chapter 10, verse 2. It says, and back at verse 1, it says, that I may perform these signs of mine among them, and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I made a mockery of the Egyptians and how I perform my signs among them, that you may know that I am the Lord. So until now, the purpose of the plagues had been to humble Egypt, to show that Egypt's gods were false, and to get the Pharaoh to release Israel. Now, God knew he wouldn't do it, but that was the purpose of the plagues. Now, we have the instructive phase. Remember, we said the plagues are both judicial and didactic. That means their judgment on the gods of Egypt, they're also meant to teach us something. And that's what this verse is saying. Now, there's an assumption in these verses. Look, it says, so that you can tell your sons and your grandsons what happened. The assumption is that fathers are going to communicate truth to their children concerning God. That's assumed there, isn't it? He says, I'm doing these plagues so that you can tell your children and your grandchildren that you saw them, and they can tell their children and grandchildren. So that's one of the purposes of the plagues, was to be a teaching tool. Look at Exodus 12. In verse 26, it's talking about the memorial to the redemption there. In verse 26, it says, and when your children say to you, what does this rite mean to you? You shall say, it is a Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over the houses of the sons of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but spared our homes. And the people bowed low and worshiped. So when the children ask, you have an answer. And in fact, Jewish people still do this today. During the Passover, they call it the Seder. They have a Passover meal, and the youngest person at the table will say, why is this day different from any other day? And then the head of the family will explain the Passover. And it's a teaching tool. And then everybody asks questions. I mean, that's kind of neat. That's a kind of a neat tradition, because that keeps the young children in the loop, so to speak. And they still do it during the Seder. That's what they have ritual questions that they ask, and then the leader of the house answers them, and then they discuss it around their Passover meal, their Seder meal. Chapter 13 and verse 8 says, you shall tell your son on that day, saying, it is because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt. And that's talking about the unleavened bread. Why do they eat the unleavened bread? It's to commemorate God's redemption of nation Israel from Egypt. Now they, of course, the Jews, don't believe the Gospels. And remember in Luke, we noticed that Jesus took the Seder, the Passover meal, and turned it into the Lord's Supper. So when the Jews looked forward to the cross at Passover time, we look backwards at the cross at communion. So Passover is not our feast. Communion is our feast. And in Luke, we saw how Jesus changed that. He said, do this in remembrance of me. And the Jews did it in remembrance of his passing over the houses of Israel in Egypt. They looked forward to a Redeemer. We look backward at our Redeemer. That's why the Lord is the Passover. And we'll get into that when we look at plague number 10. In verse 7, we notice that the servants of Pharaoh are still blaming Moses for their trouble. Verse 7 says, Pharaoh's servant said to him, how long will this man be a snare to us? Now, the text indicates here, though, that they're getting a little bit worried about Pharaoh's stubbornness. Because if you continue on in the verse, it says, let the men go that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not realize that Egypt is destroyed? So they're saying somebody's going to have to give in here. I mean, we have a conflict and it's not going to be resolved. And for all Moses knew, for all he knew, this could go on forever. Nobody told him there were only going to be 10 plagues. But they had this contest going on, and the king's advisors, or the Pharaoh's advisors, says, look, somebody's going to have to give in sooner or later, or the land will be destroyed. Why don't you give in and let Moses take his people out to worship? Now, remember who they're talking to. They're talking to God here. The Pharaoh thought he was God, and they did too. But they're getting a little bit irritated with his stubbornness. So in verse 12 through 15, we have the plague of the locusts. Chapter 10, verse 12. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt for the locusts, that they may come up on the land of Egypt and eat every plant of the land, even all that the hail has left. So Moses stretched out his staff over the land of Egypt, and the Lord directed an east wind on all that day and all that night. And when it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. The locusts came up over all the land of Egypt and settled in all the territory of Egypt. They were very numerous. There had never been so many locusts, nor would there ever be so many again. For they covered the surface of the whole land, so that the land was darkened, and they ate every plant of the land and all the fruit of the trees that the hail had left. Thus nothing green was left on tree or plant of the field through all the land of Egypt. So again, we have Moses stretching out his staff. Remember, in the first three plagues, it was Aaron who used his staff. He's the one that smacked the water in the Nile to turn it to blood. The first three plagues were Aaron. The second didn't have anybody using a staff, the second three. And then the third three, it's Moses himself using his staff. So Moses stretches out his staff, and the locusts finish everything the hail had left. So that brings us to a crisis, and Pharaoh summons Moses. And again, in verse 16, then Pharaoh hurriedly called for Moses and Aaron and said, I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you. Notice, who does Pharaoh go to get rid of the locusts? Does he go to his gods? He's got three gods he can call on to get rid of the locusts. He's got Anubis, he's got Nut, and he's got Osiris and Isis, both really, that he could call on. He doesn't call on them. He goes to Moses. So he's admitting by doing that that he knows that the God of Israel is stronger than his gods, just by the very fact that he did that. He does not call on the gods of Egypt to get him out of this mess. And he's in a big mess now. And again, he says, I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you. And again, his confession is from practical expedience. Why did he confess? He wanted to get rid of the locusts. That's why he confessed. Not because he believed it, because, man, these locusts are killing everything we have, and his confession is just out of expedience. Now, in verse 18 through 19, we get some insight into Moses' character. Verse 18 says, he went out from Pharaoh and made supplication to the Lord. So the Lord shifted the wind to a very strong west wind, which took up the locusts and drove them into the Red Sea. Not one locust was left in all the territory of Egypt. Notice, and again, Moses is a patient man. He's patient with God's way of working things. He goes out and says, okay, Pharaoh said, he admitted that he was wrong. So we'll take the locusts away and he'll let us go. For all Moses knew, these plagues, again, they could have gone on indefinitely. I mean, he could have spent the rest of his life bringing plagues on Egypt and Pharaoh refusing to heed them. Moses didn't know. We know because we read ahead. There's only going to be 10. Moses didn't know that. So he was very submissive to God's will. And remember Moses, when he started out, when God said, Moses, you go on down to Egypt and be my representative down there. Moses really backpedaled on that one. Wait a minute. I'm not the man you want. You need somebody else. And he was very reluctant to obey God. Now he seems to have caught on, and he's very submissive to God's will at this point. Now the ninth plague, the last of the sets of three, is darkness in the land. And that's in verse 21 through 29. Verse 21 says, Then the Lord said to Moses, Stretch out your hand toward the sky, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, even a darkness which may be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand toward the sky, and there was thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. And they did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days. But all the sons of Israel had light in their dwellings. Then Pharaoh called Moses and said, Go serve the Lord. Only let your flocks and your herds be detained. Even your little ones may go with you. So Pharaoh's really backpedaling now. He's saying, okay, you can take the kids with you. You can take the women with you. The only thing you can't take is your flocks. Now, what would that be a problem to Moses? How are they going to make a sacrifice without the sacrificial animals? So Moses rejects this out of hand. Verse 25, But Moses said, You must also let us have sacrifices and burnt offerings, that we may sacrifice them to the Lord our God. Therefore, our livestock too shall go with us. Not a hoof shall be left behind, for we shall take some of them to serve the Lord our God. And until we arrive there, we ourselves do not know with what we shall serve the Lord. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was not willing to let them go. Then Pharaoh said to him, Get away from me, beware, do not see my face again, for in the day you see my face, you shall die. Moses said, You are right, I shall never see your face again. So the darkness. Now, as I've mentioned several times, the plagues increase in intensity. Why would you think darkness is such a big deal? 3 days of darkness. So what? You could stumble around. You could make it by. But darkness was an offense to the God of Egypt, the big kahuna. That's Ra or Re, depending on who you read. I always was brought up calling it Ra, but a lot of people say Re. He's the sun god. So he's the one that should have been able to get rid of the plague of darkness. That's why plague number 9 is so devastating to Egypt, because it takes their big kahuna god and says he's worthless. He can't do his job. I mean, he was considered to be one of the greatest gods of Egypt. In fact, Pharaoh was his representation on earth. So this is the god that Pharaoh was. You know, Pharaoh considered himself to be a god. He wasn't just a man. And this is the god he was, Ra or Re. And he was one of the greatest gods. And if you stop and think about it, you know, they considered that the sun is necessary for life. What could be more important? Of course, people don't worship the sun anymore, do they? You can go to a high school science class And you can hear the teacher say, well, nothing on earth could have evolved without the sun. The sun is all powerful. The sun created everything. That's where you got the energy. They're applying attributes of God to something that isn't God. The sun provided the energy for evolution, and that's how we were created. Well, that's applying an attribute of God, creativeness. God created. The sun didn't create. So that's sun worship, any way you cut it. And you can go to schools and find it all over the place. Look at Genesis 1. Somebody was talking to me about the day-age theory just recently. You know what the day-age theory is? Is that the days in Genesis 1 don't represent literal 24-hour days. They represent millions and billions of years. So day one could have been millions of years long. Day two could have been millions of years long. And they attempt to, theologians do this, and they attempt to say, well, now that makes the Bible and science fit together, right? Well, it doesn't if you really read Genesis 1. The trouble with people who argue about the Bible says this and it contradicts itself here and it is in opposition to science here is that they don't read the Bible carefully. They just give it a cursory read. And they say, here we have 6 days of creation. Well, if we make those days into millions and billions of years, then we can reconcile our views with the scientist. But you can't. Why can't you? Well, look at Genesis 1:11, where it says, then God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees on the earth, bearing fruit after their kind, with seed in them. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. And God saw that it was good. Okay? That's fine. So that took millions and billions of years, right? But look down at verse 16. It says, God made two great lights. The greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. So he made the sun and the moon after he made vegetation. Does that reconcile with any science that you've ever heard? Would any evolutionist say that God made, that plant life evolved on earth before the sun was made? It doesn't. It can't. I mean, you can't compromise. It just doesn't work. The day-age theory is ridiculous. So is the gap theory, if you're wondering what my position is on that. Now, I don't care if you believe in the day-age theory, but just keep in mind, it doesn't really fit with the biblical account. Because no scientist is ever going to say that vegetation evolved before the sun was here. Now, when people take the day-age theory, I say to them sometimes, you know, that's kind of like, what do you have down here? We have possums in Nebraska. Possum walking down the middle of the road. It gets hit by trucks going both ways. So the evolutionists will laugh at you because the sequence is wrong, and the creationists will laugh at you. So you kind of get it from both sides there. That's just my opinion on what the text of Genesis 1 says, but just to note, when a day, the word yom, and they make a big deal about, well, yom can be used for a period of time, like the day of the Lord, that's not just one day, that's a whole period of time. How can you tell me that day means a single day in Genesis? Well, there's two reasons. One, it has a numerical adjective. The first day, the second day, the third day. You never see the word yom in the entire Hebrew Bible with a numerical adjective when it's not talking about a regular 24-hour literal day. And the second reason is the morning, evening. It says it was morning and it was evening. And you never see that in the Old Testament unless it's talking about a single day, morning and evening. So there's really two grammatical reasons, and there's just the logical reason that the sequence is wrong that disproves the day-age theory, in my opinion. I admit that's my opinion, but it's based on an exegesis of the Hebrew text. There's nothing in the text there that would indicate that a yom in that chapter is anything but a 24-hour literal day. There's just nothing in the grammar or the context that you can go to. You have to make it up. They go to 1 Timothy, the first or second, and said, to the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like a day. So if they say a day is an indefinite period of time, that makes that nonsense, doesn't it? Because it makes it say, well, to the Lord, an indefinite period of time is like 1,000 years. And 1,000 years is like an indefinite period of time. What sense does that make? And they use that to prove the day-age theory, and it disproves it. Enough ranting. The sun god, Ra, Re, consistently, every day, he brought warmth, he brought light, he brought productivity. Why wouldn't you worship him? As I mentioned, we still do in our schools. So this consistency was interpreted by the Egyptians as faithfulness. So what would happen if it was dark for 3 days? That puts a big bite in their religion. Their God can't even give them light when it compared or put up against the God of Israel. Let me read a poem, or a hymn, actually, an Egyptian hymn. It says, "Hail to thee, beautiful ray, sun of every day, who rises at dawn without ceasing. Fine gold is not like the radiance of thee. Thou who hast constructed thyself," and Ra was supposed to be the God, the maker who didn't have a maker. Nobody made him. He was pre-existent. And he made all the other gods. In fact, I think Isis and Osiris were his grandchildren, if I'm not mistaken, but I could be wrong on that. "Thou didst fashion thy body, a shaper who was not shaped, unique in his nature, passing eternity, the distant one under whose guidance are millions of ways. Just as thy radiance is like the radiance of heaven, and thy color glistens more than its surface." So that's what they thought of their sun god. And the God of Israel just said, okay, darkness, 3 days. We'll show you how strong your sun god really is. See what he's doing? He's addressing their gods. There were other gods that were associated with the sun. Horus, Nut, they would have been humiliated by the plague too. Remember, Nut had the sun going through her and then coming back out. That would have been devastating to that god too. So how intense was this darkness? Was it a dust cloud caused by the barren land? You hear that a lot. Say, well, yeah, the locusts ate all the green, so the land didn't have anything to hold the dirt down, so a wind came up and it got dusty and nobody could see anything. Does this sound like that to you? And this, it just doesn't fit. 3 days, the Israelites and the Egyptians were confined to their homes and they couldn't see a thing. And for the Egyptians, at least, the text seems to indicate that they didn't even have light inside. They couldn't even light a lamp. Because it says there was light in the Israelites' home. So that implies that there was no light in the Egyptians' home. So they couldn't even light a lamp to get around. So this was darkness. The Israelites had light in 10:22 and 23. It says, So Moses stretched out his hand toward the sky, and there was thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days. But all the sons of Israel had light in their dwellings. See how that implies that the Egyptians didn't? The word thick darkness is interesting too. Literally, in Hebrew it says dark darkness. In verse 21, it's described as being so thick you could feel it. Now imagine that kind of a darkness. The Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward the sky and that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, even a darkness which may be felt. So that was dark, dark darkness. Now, it just doesn't fit with a dust storm. Is that a dust storm that obscures the sun for a while? But what happens in a dust storm? Does it turn black? No, it gets dark, I'll admit that, but is it black that you can't even see enough to move? And couldn't you go inside and light a lamp? They couldn't. Much too intense to be a dust storm. Again, there's an exemption. The Israelites had light in their house. Now, God was not judging the Israelites. He was judging the gods of Egypt. So Pharaoh makes an offer now. And Moses makes a reply. And that's 24 through 26. Verse 24, it says, then Pharaoh called to Moses and said, go serve the Lord. Only let your flocks and your herds be detained. Even your little ones may go with you. So now he's saying the whole family can go, but you have to leave your animals. Well, again, Moses says no. In verse 25, but Moses said, you must also let us have sacrifices and burnt offerings that we may sacrifice them to the Lord our God. So Moses rejects the offer completely. Just no way. We're going to take our animals with us. Pharaoh's response to this is in verse 27 and 28. He gives Moses a harsh warning. He says, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was not willing to let them go. Then Pharaoh said to him, get away from me. Beware, do not see my face again, for in the day you see my face, you shall die. So when his offer is rejected, and I'm sure Pharaoh thought he was doing Israel an incredibly great favor by letting them go. Only he's going to keep their animals so he's sure they'll come back. I think the whole time here he's afraid they're going to go and not come back. Well, when we get to the 10th plague, he's going to tell them don't come back. So, and that's what God told Moses to begin with. So it works out exactly like God said it would. Imagine that. So Moses has to leave the presence of Pharaoh. And to return would be a death sentence. In verse 29, Moses' parting words, Moses said, you are right, I shall never see your face again. He agreed, but he had one more plague. There was one more plague that had to come. And the 10th plague is going to bring about the release of nation Israel. Now let's just review then the point of the plagues. Why did God send these plagues on Egypt? 9 of them, very harsh. They ended up being very, very harsh plagues. Is God just a capricious God who likes to send trouble down on people so he can get entertained by it? Some people think of God that way. No. These plagues were sent for specific reasons. First, they were an indictment and judgment on the gods of Egypt. Egypt worshipped false gods, and God said, I'm going to show you your gods are false. Now, this lesson was meant not only for the Egyptians, but for the Israelites. Look at Joshua 24. Joshua 24, and in verse 14, It says, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. See, that implies that Israel was worshiping Egypt's gods. So this lesson is intended for both Egyptians and Israelites. And some of the Egyptians listened. They left with them. The plagues were a demonstration of God's existence and God's power. In Exodus chapter 7 and verse 5, it says, the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst. So God's going to teach them. Remember, it's judicial and didactic. It was a demonstration. The plagues were God's means of forcing Pharaoh to release Israel from Egypt, and we'll see that in the 10th plague. And they were also a prototype. Remember when we studied Revelation, how the plagues are very similar in the book of Revelation to the book of Exodus. Just by way of review, the first three plagues we called the discomfort plagues. First, the Nile was turned to blood, and Pharaoh was warned when he went down to the Nile in the morning. And the gods of Egypt are listed in the next column in the application, so you can see which gods the blood, Nile turned to blood. There was Hapi, Apis, the bull god of the Nile, Osiris, the god of the afterlife. Remember, he represented resurrection, and so did the Nile River, because every year the Nile would overflow, and it would bring fresh soil to the delta region, and then it would bring new life. And so they considered that to be resurrection of the land. And they said that that the Nile River was resurrected the land of Egypt every year. So that's how Osiris gets into it. Isis, Osiris's wife, goddess of the Nile. Kanua, the ram god, was supposed to be the guardian of the Nile. Then we had the frogs. And remember Hekat, she had a frog head, ugly looking thing. She was the goddess of birth. Now the first two, the magicians duplicated. They could do that. And in the second one, the second one is humorous. I mean, they couldn't kill frogs. They were inundated with frogs, and the Egyptian magicians could make more frogs. That's not what Pharaoh wanted. He wanted to get rid of the frogs. The third one, the gnats, Set, the desert god, would be the one attacked there. And the magicians tried to make gnats and they couldn't. That's where they failed. From now on, the first two they could duplicate, the rest they could not. So they ended up saying, this is the finger of God. That's what the magician said. Now the destruction plagues were the flies, the livestock killed, and the boils. So Pharaoh starts to bargain here. He said, you can go into the desert, but don't go too far. And then of course when the flies were gone, he changed his mind and said you couldn't go. And then the livestock were killed. And in these plagues, the flies start the exemption of nation Israel. And that carries down to the livestock. Israel's cattle were exempt from that. Pharaoh did not change his mind. And then the boils. Sekhmet, remember the lion-headed goddess, she was the goddess of disease. She should have been able to prevent that plague of boils from happening. The magicians couldn't even get up to stand before Moses by this time because they had so many boils. And then what we looked at this morning, the death plagues or the dread plagues, some people call them. We had the storm. The warning was this, let my people go or else I'll set my plagues on you full force. Pharaoh still refused. The locusts then came and destroyed what the hail had left. Now the officials are pleading for the release of Israel before the plague, and Pharaoh bargains a little further this time. He said only the men can go, and then the locusts, Anubis, Nut, Osiris, Cyrus, and then the darkness. That was the kicker, because that was their main god, Ra, or Re, the god of the sun, a sun god. He was the big kahuna god in Egypt. And the God of Israel said, your sun god is a pretty hot character, huh? Darkness, 3 days, just like that. So he proved to the Egyptians, he proved to the Israelites that those were false gods. And what happens? Israel gets released, they cross the Red Sea, and a couple weeks later they're worshiping false gods again when they get to the mountain of God. So we'll get to that in its due course. Father, thank you again for your word and your history of Moses and the plagues sent on Egypt and Egypt's false gods. We pray that we can be very careful about applying attributes of God to things that aren't God, because that is abhorrent to you, and we know that, and we just pray that we can worship you and you alone. In Christ's name, amen.